Here's a man I've known almost my entire life. Our family grew up with his family, and he was one of my parents' closest friends. He's someone I've always respected and admired, and I didn't know he was Hingham's first black police officer. In fact, he represents a number of firsts. Say what? Would you believe it? Here's a young fellow, third generation Hingham, comes to one of those renowned dances in the Teague family barn on Ward Street in Tuttleville. In fact, his middle name is Tuttle. He meets his future wife, Jean. He enlists in the army. He returns home to start his family on Ward Street. Who is Louis Tuttle Benito? And what shaped his outlook on life to become a U.S. Army drill instructor, then Hingham's first black police officer, then becoming one of the first black real estate brokers on the South Shore, and then eventually becoming one of IBM's first black account executives? Louis, as he became known to his family and friends, is a man of firsts. Let's meet him. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello, Joel.
How are you today?
Joe, you know, my stock answer is, and it's very true, it's the best day of my life.
Well, that's a wonderful thing, for sure.
Yeah.
So we're here to hear your story. We want to find out who you are, the man, what were the influences that shaped you and the choices that you made in your life. And then we're also going to have your son, your oldest, join us in this conversation. So let's first start with your earliest recollections of growing up in Hingham and the decision that you made to become a police officer. But before we do, you were in the United States Army.
Right.
You want to share with us a little bit about that?
After studying at the University of Mass Amherst, I was drafted, would you believe, into the service during the Korean War, the end of the Korean War. And going through the basic training and all the good things that happened to you, I decided, including traffic going from New Jersey to New York, and I was tempted to go AWOL, but I said, no, that's not right. And I hung in there, and then I had to do some KP, and I said, there must be a better way, so I ended up going to OCS and becoming an officer. Before this all happened, though, I was going with the most beautiful young lady I ever encountered, and I asked her, I've just been drafted, will you wait for me? And without hesitation, she said, no. Took me aback a little bit, but anyway, I went in the service and then we got married when I was in the service. I never became part of the combat, but I was en route to combat when Tut here was supposedly coming out as a breech berth. Back in that day, they would give you an emergency leave for such things. And when that emergency leave was over, the computer said that Lieutenant Benito does not have yet enough time to serve because the draftee is in there for a specific amount of time. He's got to go back where he was. He's not going overseas. So Tut probably saved my life.
Once you got out of the Army, when did you decide you wanted to join the Hingham Police Department?
Well, that was a decision that was part of a reaction to an invitation. I grew up in, you know, I was about the third generation in Hingham of the Tuttles. And my mother was the youngest of six Tuttles. The family was in Tuttleville, which became Tuttleville, that section of Ward Street back in the day. I went to the First Baptist Church of Hingham. That's where I found the Lord as a young 10-year-old in the activities down there. But also Oscar Beck, who happened to be the chief of police. It was a family, and he and his people invited me to, do I want a job there? Well, I just happened to need a job at that time. And I accepted it, and I was one of several recruits. I think you have a picture of the other people who came in at the same time I did, and that was it. I became a member of the police force in Hingham, Massachusetts.
So let's talk about that for a minute. What was it like being a man of color, breaking a color barrier in this community in the early 60s, 1962, I believe, to be exact, is that photograph to which you refer. You're standing outside the police station. I'm just curious as to how were you perceived by the community? How were you received by your fellow officers, supported by your superior officers?
Joe, I think what carries people in different directions is their attitude. Now, having grown up in Hingham and knowing a lot of people, it's a very small town at the time. There were like 20,000 people, I think the population was, and there was a group of six families of color that I knew of. And they were the Reeds, the Freedies, the Tuttles, of course. And there was a young person named Mabel Diggs, and there was a lady that lived across the street from us named Mrs. Young, and then Mrs. Kendall, who brought up her two grandchildren, the Roundtrees. When you know everybody, and everybody knows you, and particularly if you're a very small minority, and you're not a threat to anybody, because the threat aspect grew as the civil rights movement grew. And then you remember all of the fuss and bust about busing and all that stuff, when all of a sudden the small minority became visible. And that's when it starts to become a quote threat, if you will, to those in power. And then you got the exposure of the systematic racism that's always there and is still there. When I was working long days mowing people's lawns, and watched those people. I'm thinking particularly about a family that I worked for a long time, Harold Downing, right down in center Hingham. He's a very successful oil broker, I think. But he was on the phone just talking and making a living, a very handsome living, going to the yacht club and all that stuff. And I said, there must be a better way than all this manual stuff that I've been doing here. And observation of that kind of things, which I took to heart, if you will.
Now, I'd like to give Tut a chance to weigh in. Tut, how did you feel about your father being on the Hingham Police Department? What were your earliest recollections? Did you feel proud? Did you feel bullied, intimidated at school? And what were your overall impressions?
It was cool. And I received no negative feedback from any of my classmates or whatever. It was cool. And, you know, little kid, and there's my father. He's got this cool uniform and this cool gun. The respect that came along with the position was shown. I had a couple of classmates who saw my father. They didn't even know he was my father. When they found out, they were very respectful. They liked him. He was a very good police officer. It was a very positive thing.
You were sharing a story earlier about when your dad joined the force and he had a conversation with you about boys and guns. You want to tell us about that?
I think he did the best thing that any father could do with a young son and guns. Taught me to respect the weapon, to appreciate what it could do, because once that hammer drops, there's no calling that bullet back, and they are very unforgiving. So I learned the proper respect, and he also said, anytime you want to see it or handle it, let me know, and I'll show it to you. And if it was 3 o'clock in the morning and I decided I wanted to see the gun, he was true to his word and did let me handle it and show it. I didn't get to fire it, but it taught me that it's just as important when to use a weapon as it is how to use one. And that's really important. We never had any accidents. I was warned strictly, do not touch it when I'm not there with you. And I never did.
Is it true that I heard that he would handcuff the revolver?
Oh yeah, he would put his cuffs through, open the cylinder and put his cuffs through the frame. And I think, Dad, wasn't it behind the trigger, between the trigger guard and the trigger as well? So there was absolutely no way, unless you had a handcuff key, which I didn't, to even close the cylinder. So he took no chances, and it was not it never became an issue. You know, we were always cool around the guns.
Now, Mr. B.
Yes, sir.
You are also a man of firsts in several other areas, and let's talk about that. You got your broker's license. You were one of the very first people of color to get a real estate broker's license here on the South Shore. Is that correct?
That's correct. I was successful in placing a black family right behind the library in down central Hingham, the Rices. So on the South Shore, I was active. That was interesting because the one thing I remember is a long listing session with a family that was moving to Hawaii from a middle-class area in Randolph. And they wanted my word that I would not sell it to a black family. And I was trying to rationalize with them, I ain't gonna do that, I'm sorry. But there was a long discussion. I remember I was there till like midnight in that discussion. And they did not see their way. I did not take the listing.
You also had an interesting conversation with Jack Conway of Conway Real Estate in the early days.
Now, he was the man, if you will, in the organization on the South Shore. When people began to become a little aware that the people of color also wanted to and were able to buy houses, it got their attention. And then when you see someone who's kind of helping them do that, the attention is even more so. But it was a brief conversation, and I didn't think about working for somebody, which, you know, I chose to try to surge ahead on my own because I was having a moderate amount of success at the time.
And now let's talk about IBM. You became one of the first black account executives for IBM.
That was a result of the times when someone, and I'm not sure who, in IBM, very high, said, I don't know if it was pangs of conscience or if they finally realized that these people of color were handling money and able to address that sacred clientele that they had. And they said, maybe there'll be some people of color who might qualify for this. And I was fortunate enough to be one of five people that they put on the rolls and on the road and in a position to face their sacred clientele. And it was a real blessing. Nobody makes it on their own. And whether it's, you know, you can make, cut a path for those to follow, but ahead of you, there has to be people in that entity that are gonna help you do your thing. And I was very fortunate to have a super manager.
Now, I recall an interesting story that you shared about checking into the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami. You want to share a little bit about that?
Well, that hotel was pretty exclusive, if you want to call it that. I don't know what it is now. And there were, I think all five of us made the 100% club. That was the club. And part of the reward for doing that was this conference and in this very posh place. And you get the looks and you get the suspicion, and then you get from a lot of the people of color who work there, they are a little bit suspect also, whereas now I think the majority of those people would be in your corner. And maybe 50% of them are looking askance at you as you come in as an equal to these people that they are ready to serve. And that was kind of an eye-opener.
Now, they didn't initially want to rent you a room. My understanding is that Tom Watson, then CEO of IBM, had to make a phone call.
I don't know if it was Mr. Watson, but somebody made a call. I had two incidents. One was right here, right there in Boston, where this corrupt sergeant in charge of purchasing for the Boston Army Base, he used to come to work driven in a limousine. And when I showed up to on behalf of IBM, he said, don't send him anymore to me with some expletives and some everything else. And IBM made a call and he was replaced very, very quickly. And that was, again, the testament that the decision to hire us wasn't made lightly. And when it was made with all of the things in the background to make it work.
Were you aware of the fact that you were breaking these color barriers, and were you motivated to do these things for others, or were you just pushing this to achieve for your own individual goals?
at first you go along and you try to do the best you can for yourself. And then you look around and say, well, you know, maybe, gee whiz, maybe I can help someone else. Now, when I was with IBM, first in Baltimore, I had a time where I was loaned out to the citizenry there. I had a classroom full of computers and teaching people off the street almost. People a lot less fortunate than I was. Everything from simple how to dress for success to how to have the right attitude for the right work ethic and so forth. And some of the basic things that you and I have seen that our people need and maybe still do somewhere. Not like it used to be. But in recognizing the hardship or the prejudice that was around, you're aware of it. But from a positive background and upbringing, I wasn't going to let that stain my view of the world. And that's what I think is happening today, that people are being rewarded for being victims and thinking victims. And as the old folks said, maybe I'm one of them, that ain't right.
Tut?
Yes.
You've watched your dad break through many of these barriers.
Yeah.
You're the oldest of four in your family. Your sister Deirdre, your brother Scott, your younger sister Allison. How has that shaped you? What were some of those impressions that you saw both your mom and your dad, particularly including their work with the South Shore Citizens Club?
I am exceedingly blessed to have been born to the parents I was born to. And one of the major blessings was growing up, we were the most unracial family. Anyone that walked through the door, we never saw color. In our neighborhood, it was 60% black and 40% white, roughly. I never thought about that. So if someone came into our house, you were considered family until you proved otherwise. That's been a major blessing ever since, because I've gotten to know people from a bunch of different ethnicities and backgrounds, that if I had grown up in a household where race was the predominant issue, that may have cost me bothering to get to know certain people that are very good friends of mine now. So yeah, I'm very blessed to have been born to my particular father and my particular mother.
Mr. B, you have a birthday coming up soon, don't you?
I do.
How old are you going to be?
I'll be 91.
You are also recovering from COVID?
Yes, I spent the first half of July this 2020 in the ICU.
Mr. Lewis, Tuttle Benito, Senior. Mr. Lewis, Tuttle Benito, Junior. This has been a very invaluable and honorable experience to visit with you both and to have you, Mr. B, share your experiences. This is the part of the history of Tuttleville that continues to unfold. And we thank you so much for taking this time with us today.
His family has grown, four children. Tuttle, Deirdre, also India, Scott, and Allison. And 9 grandchildren and 10 great-grandchildren. I remember his family as having a home full of love where everyone was welcomed and treated equally. Mr. and Mrs. Benito were members of the South Shore Citizens Club and charter members of the South Shore NAACP. It is no surprise that this is a family of firsts, thanks to Lewis Tuttle Benito, breaking barriers.